Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Pat Livingston. Today, we're embarking on a thorough and detailed deep dive into Bloomberg for Friday, August 8th, 2025.
And I'm Chris Sinclair. It's really a pleasure to be here, synthesizing today's pretty diverse information, helping you connect the dots and understand not just what is happening globally, but, you know, why it matters and what the broader implications might be. We're here to provide context, different perspectives, really encouraging you to think critically about the insights we unpack.
Exactly. Our mission with every deep dive is to offer you that shortcut to being truly well-informed. We take a stack of sources, boil them down into essential knowledge. Today's deep dive is a comprehensive exploration of Bloomberg's top reports. We'll cover intricate market shifts, evolving economic policies, cutting-edge tech advancements, significant social transformations, and some pretty pressing geopolitical developments. Think of this as your essential briefing for navigating, well, a complex world. We'll delve into the impact and implications of each article, providing balanced viewpoints without endorsing any specific stance. We're just here to convey the ideas, allowing you to form your own informed opinions. So let's jump right in with Section 1, Global Economic Currents and Market Reactions. We're starting with the U.S. economic landscape, specifically the labor market, the Fed's stance, and, well, the noticeable influence of presidential actions.
Yeah, this is a really crucial starting point because the latest economic data, it genuinely challenges some, let's say, deeply held assumptions about the health of the U.S. economy.
It absolutely does. The core information here, it paints a picture of a rapidly cooling labor market. U.S. continuing jobless claims recently surged, highest level since the end of 2021. And initial claims also came in slightly higher than economists had expected, at 226,000. But the real headline, the one that grabbed attention, was the government's July employment report. It revealed a significant slowdown in job creation and, crucially, included these outsized downward revisions to the May and June numbers. This amounted to a combined 258,000 fewer payroll increases than initially reported. That's huge.
Yeah, huge.
So when you consider those revised figures, employment growth averaged, a paltry 35,000 the past 3 months, marking the weakest period since the pandemic hit.
And this data is immensely significant because it directly contradicts that narrative of a solid labor market, right? A phrase Federal Reserve officials have used quite frequently. It points to a much more substantial deceleration than anyone had truly anticipated. It's raising red flags for investors, for economists. The unexpected weakness suggests the labor market might be in a worse position than previously thought, which, of course, has cascading effects on all economic forecasts and, critically, on monetary policy decisions. It really forces a fundamental reevaluation of the economic trajectory the Fed's been navigating.
And the political response to these numbers was, well, immediate and, frankly, pretty dramatic. President Donald Trump reacted swiftly, fired the Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner Erica McIntyre. He outright claimed the numbers were rigged and not fair and accurate. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent defended this action, calling the BLS's error a 5-6 standard deviation mistake, and argued that a revamp was long overdue, citing issues with low employer response rates in their surveys.
Right. And while data revisions are, you know, a routine part of economic reporting, they happen all the time as more complete information becomes available, the sheer magnitude of this particular revision. Coupled with that immediate political reaction is highly unusual. It sparks an absolutely critical discussion about the independence of statistical agencies, doesn't it? Agencies designed to be impartial. When the very source of foundational economic figures is challenged, labeled as rigged by political leaders, it inevitably impacts the public's trust in government data. This isn't just about a single data point. It's about the integrity of information itself, how it underpins public and market confidence.
Yeah, exactly. And this leads us directly into the Federal Reserve's dilemma. That unexpectedly weak jobs report, it has significantly amplified expectations for the Fed to cut interest rates, probably at their next policy meeting in September. Yet Fed officials have maintained a consistent stance, right? They've left their benchmark rates unchanged throughout 2025. What's particularly telling is that two Fed officials, Governor Christopher Waller and Atlanta Fed President Raphael Bostic, actually dissented from the recent hold decision. They explicitly argued for a quarter-point rate cut. They perceived the labor market as significantly weaker than initial reports had suggested. So given these conflicting signals, cooling economy on one side, but, you know, persistent inflation concerns and these new tariffs on the other, how much genuine room to maneuver does the Fed actually have? It really seems like they're walking a very fine line here.
That's precisely the challenge. Raphael Bostic, for one, he's been quite vocal about his skepticism regarding the inflationary effects of these tariffs. He still believes one interest rate cut is likely this year. but he explicitly stated, somewhat skepticism, that the inflationary effects from tariffs will be merely temporary. He argues that the frequent evolution of tariffs, rather than just a one-time event, risks lifting inflation expectations and could cause structural changes to U.S. supply chains, maybe well into 2026. So this isn't a simple transitory price bump that the Fed can just sort of look through and ignore. The implications of these trade policies are much deeper for their mandate.
And adding another complex layer to this whole equation is the direct presidential influence on monetary policy. President Trump has been openly, consistently critical of the Fed, repeatedly blaming Chair Jerome Powell for not lowering rates sooner. He argues the Fed's current stance is keeping the federal government's debt servicing costs artificially high and actively suppressing economic growth.
Now, Trump is preparing to nominate Stephen Mearn, currently the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, as a temporary Federal Reserve governor. Mearn is a known ally who strongly supports Trump's push for rate cuts, and his term would expire in January, potentially giving Trump more time to decide on a successor for Powell, with Waller currently seen as a top candidate for the Fed chair position.
This situation, it really spotlights a profound tension between political objectives and central bank independence, which is, of course, designed to be free from such pressures. While a temporary appointment like Mearn's might not fundamentally alter the Fed's overall trajectory in the long run, it undeniably signals a clear presidential attempt to influence monetary policy at a critical juncture. And that debate over whether tariffs cause temporary or persistent inflation, that's absolutely crucial for the Fed's decision-making. It directly impacts their dual mandate, maximum employment and price stability. So the confluence of a softening labor market, mounting inflation concerns, and direct political pressure, it creates a truly complex, arguably unprecedented environment for future rate decisions. It's a delicate balancing act with very high stakes for the entire global economy.
Building on that economic volatility, let's pivot to Section 1.2. We're diving into trade wars and global impact, specifically looking at the sweeping reach of Trump's tariffs and the varied responses we're seeing around the world.
Yeah, this is undoubtedly a reshaping of global economic relations, and the ripple effects are becoming increasingly clear, aren't they?
It certainly is. The scope of Trump's tariffs is quite remarkable. President Trump is barreling forward, as Bloomberg puts it, with his turbulent push to rewrite the global order through sweeping new tariffs, which officially took effect just yesterday. This marks a decisive retreat by the U.S. from its post-1945 commitment to open markets. We're seeing major allies like the European Union, Japan, South Korea, reluctantly accepting 15% duties on their products, including key exports like automobiles. Switzerland was assigned an even higher 39% duty and failed in its last-ditch efforts to lower it.
Wow, 39%.
Right. Furthermore, Trump announced he would double tariffs on India to a staggering 50% for its purchases of Russian oil, and he has threatened a 100% tariff on semiconductor imports, though with a distinct exemption for companies that move production back to the U.S. What truly stands out here is how Trump's approach is like an economic earthquake, right?
Yeah.
Sending tremors through every corner of global trade. He's effectively inverting the post-war paradigm of open markets, multilateral cooperation. He's compelling allies to accept unequal relationships, dramatically boost their defense spending if they want to maintain access to the U.S. market, and continued military protection. It's a fundamental shift in how international trade and alliances are being structured, moving towards a more transactional, less collaborative model.
And the responses, the economic fallout from these policies are incredibly diverse. It vividly illustrates just how deeply these tariffs are impacting companies and nations worldwide.
On the corporate side, we're seeing some fascinating adjustments. Toyo Tire Corp, they plan a $30 billion, about $85.6 million, investment to expand U.S. output, aiming to absorb the tariff impacts domestically. Apple Inc. actually airlifted 600 tons of iPhones out of India just before the tariffs took effect, a testament to the urgency companies feel to avoid these duties.
That's incredible. 600 tons.
Yeah. General Motors cut, they reported a significant $1.1 billion decline in quarterly profit, largely because it decided to absorb tariff costs rather than passing them on to consumers, opting to protect market share. Crocs, Inc. expects tariffs to directly drive down its revenue, and Ralph Lauren Corp. is being very cautious about how U.S. consumers will respond to their planned price increases under this new regime.
And the global reactions have been equally striking, a mix of defiance and, well, pragmatic adaptation. India, despite facing that hefty 50% tariff, has no plans to retaliate, but is clearly reassessing its strategic tilt toward the U.S. and is now looking to traditional allies like Russia, maybe even China, for protection against what it perceives as aggressive U.S. actions. Mm. In a surprising turn, Brazil's president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva defied Trump's demands to drop charges against Jair Bolsonaro, which predictably led to selective tariffs on Brazilian coffee and beef. This move, however, has ironically infuriated Brazilians, rallying support for Lula rather than weakening him, showcasing a nationalist backlash against external pressure.
Interesting.
And in Canada, the big box retailer Canadian Tire Corp reported significant sales jumps, benefiting from a Buy Canada wave as consumers boycott U.S. companies amidst the trade war, indicating a nationalist purchasing trend playing out right there in the market.
Wow. Economists are already ringing alarm bells about the broader economic impact. Experts like Torsten Slok of Apollo Management warn of stagflation, that toxic mix of higher inflation and slower economic growth, which they believe the Federal Reserve is helpless to remedy. In for Kist, we're already seeing import prices inching up, suggesting that foreign companies are not absorbing the tariffs. Instead, U.S. companies will eventually face a profit hit and a price hike when their current untariffed inventories run out. While customs duties collected by the U.S. government have surged to a record $113 billion over the 9 months through June, the ultimate goal of bringing manufacturing jobs back to America, it remains unproven, raising questions about the true efficacy of these policies.
This complex picture reveals a core aspect of Trump's us versus them trade policy, where traditional alliances, multilateral agreements, they hold significantly less weight than the perceived deal or unilateral leverage. The long-term consequences could very well be a smaller global economy, new tensions, with critics arguing U.S. consumers and companies will ultimately bear the cost. Conversely, countries like Japan and Europe, by choosing not to retaliate, instead absorbing the duties, might actually fare better in the long run by remaining open to trade, upholding the principles of a multilateral system, positioning themselves for a potential rebound if U.S. policy shifts again. This dynamic will profoundly shape international economic relations for years to come, creating new winners and losers, fundamentally redefining global supply chains.
Okay, with all these complex economic signals, let's take a quick pulse check on how the markets are reacting today, Friday, August 8th, 2025. Gold futures surged at the end of the week, buffeted by tariffs, geopolitics, corporate earnings. European stocks, U.S. futures steadied. Stocks Europe 600 up 0.2%. S&P 500 futures up 0.2%. NASDAQ 100 futures up 0.2%. Dow Jones futures up 0.1%. The MSCI Asia Pacific Index was little changed. MSCI Emerging Markets Index fell 0.6%. Currencies, Bloomberg Dollar Spot Index little changed. Euro fell 0.2% to 1.1647. Japanese yen fell 0.2% to 147.44 per dollar. Bitcoin fell 0.6% to $116,517.69. Bonds yield on 10-year treasuries unchanged at 4.25%. Brent crude and spot gold little changed today. So despite all that turbulence we just discussed, notice how relatively stable the broader indices are, right? Suggests that while individual company sectors are feeling the pinch, the market overall is maybe pricing in a certain level of volatility, or perhaps it's a calm before a potential storm, as these macro forces haven't fully played out yet. Gold's rise, of course, classic flight to safety, confirms investor jitters.
That snapshot of relative stability, particularly with gold showing its safe haven strength, is really intriguing, isn't it? But to truly understand how these macro shifts like tariffs, interest rate speculation are playing out, we need to zoom in on individual companies. Let's look at some of today's key corporate earnings and stock movements, because their stories often tell us more than the broad indices alone.
Good idea. Let's start with some of the major declines reported today. Munich Re shares dropped 8.6% after cutting full-year revenue guidance, pulled the entire insurance sector lower. TBC Bank Group PLR slumped more than 13% after reporting disappointing second-quarter earnings. In the pharmaceutical world, Chugai Pharmaceutical Co. shares tumbled the most since 1977, following disappointing late-stage trial data for an obesity drug licensed to Eli Lilly & Co., which in turn caused Eli Lilly shares to plunge 14%, while their main European rival, Novo Nordisk AS, soared 6.7% as a direct beneficiary.
Wow, big swings there.
Yeah. On the tech front, Pinterest Inc. shares fell as much as 14% after hours, followed an earnings miss and flat user growth in the lucrative U.S. and Canada markets. We also saw Nextdoor, the social media company, announce it was cutting 67 jobs, part of a restructuring plan to save $30 million annually, become profitable. Its CFO also resigned.
These declines, they paint a clear picture of how specific company challenges, whether it's guidance cuts, clinical trial failures, struggles with user growth, are being heavily penalized by investors in the current climate. It also highlights how interconnected sectors are, doesn't it? one company's misstep can directly benefit a competitor.
But it wasn't all bad news. Some companies saw significant gains. Lotus Bakery's NV jumped as much as 8.3%. Reported strong sales growth for its popular Biscoff cookies. Shows that even simple consumer goods can deliver big returns.
Everyone loves Biscoff.
Right. Block Inc., Jack Dorsey's company, raised its full-year profit guidance after Q2 earnings beat expectations. Driven by strength in its Cash App lending business, resilient payment volumes, shares rose about 8% after hours. Flutter Entertainment PLC, parent of FanDuel, raised its 2025 outlook after favorable U.S. sports bets managed to offset tax charges. Revenue now expected to grow 23%. Instacart posted its strongest order growth since 2022 for a second consecutive quarter, beat earnings estimates, showing resilience in its core delivery business. Thai Airways International Passenger shares soared to a 7-year high after its Q2 net income jumped nearly 39-fold. A remarkable turnaround story.
39-fold. Incredible.
Intime Financial Inc. topped Wall Street estimates in its first quarterly results as a public company. Shares soared a stunning 37% on its debut day back in June, signaling strong investor confidence in fintech.
These gains really demonstrate how strategic positioning in growing sectors, successful restructuring, or hitting profitability milestones can lead to significant investor upside, even amidst broader market uncertainty. Companies with strong consumer appeal or those benefiting from secular trends like digital payments, online delivery, they're finding strong support.
We also have some mixed or noteworthy movements. Intel Core shares dropped 3.1% after President Trump called for CEO Lip-Bu Tan's resignation over alleged conflicts of interest with China, though Tan quickly affirmed he had full board backing.
That's messy.
Yeah. General Motors Company announced plans to purchase EV batteries from China to power an upcoming entry-level EV. Until U.S.-made batteries are available in about 2 years, meaning it will face tariffs on these imports. Apple Inc. stock is down 15% in 2025. Among the NASDAQ 100's worst performers, struggling to convince investors on its AI strategy, managed tariff risks, despite quarterly revenues climbing 10% year over year. By contrast, Microsoft and Meta platforms saw revenue growth of 18% and 22% respectively, highlighting Apple's challenge in the AI narrative. JP Morgan estimates losing Google revenue alone could cut Apple's profits by 10%. Ralph Lauren Corp. reported robust growth, strong sales in Europe and Asia, but expressed caution about U.S. consumer response to tariffs and planned price hikes. Acushnet Holdings Corp., owner of Titleist, posted record quarterly sales, indicating golf's surprising resilience. Lastly, Warner Bros. Discovery, Inc. swung to a profit in Q2, buoyed by box office successes like a Minecraft movie. But its television network's unit saw sales decline, falling pay TV subscribers, advertising revenue. The company now plans to split into two separate entities to address these diverging fortunes.
These diverse corporate results, they offer a truly granular look into how larger macroeconomic forces like tariffs, interest rates, consumer confidence actually play out at the individual company level. We see clear winners, clear losers, demonstrating how adaptability, strategic market positioning, for example, in AI or specific consumer segments, and even geopolitical exposure can profoundly impact financial performance. The struggles of some tech giants to articulate a compelling AI strategy versus others seeing rapid growth highlights the uneven distribution of benefits from the AI boom, shows that not all boats are rising equally in this tech tide. It reinforces that even industry leaders aren't immune to market shifts or political pressures.
Now let's transition to section two, energy, climate, and infrastructure shifts. We'll kick things off with a deep dive into oil market dynamics and geopolitics.
Right. This area is always a fascinating blend, isn't it? Economics, international power plays, the ever-present influence of global events.
Absolutely. The core information here reveals some interesting oil price trends. Oil is currently heading for its longest losing run since 2021. Brent crude falling towards $66 per barrel. West Texas Intermediate below $64. Brent, in fact, has declined for a seventh straight session. This is happening as traders are judging that U.S. efforts to end the war in Ukraine will not significantly impact overall oil supplies, even as Washington penalizes India for buying Russian crude. U.S. President Donald Trump had set a Friday deadline for Moscow to agree to a truce, express willingness to meet with Putin, even if the Russian leader hasn't yet agreed to meet with Ukrainian President Zelensky.
This market behavior suggests a prevailing sentiment that, despite the sanctions, despite the political pressure, Russian oil will continue to find buyers, or that global supply is simply sufficient to absorb any disruption. It highlights the market's inherent skepticism about the effectiveness of political maneuvers in fundamentally altering global oil flows. And it potentially anticipates a continued, albeit perhaps rerouted, supply even from sanctioned sources. Essentially, the market is pricing in a continuation of the status quo, even if it's an uneasy one, prioritizing established supply routes over geopolitical aspirations.
So If the U.S. is penalizing India for buying Russian oil, that raises a huge question about Russian oil displacement and China's role. Washington's efforts to restrict Russian oil flows to India, which took about 1.7 million barrels per day last month, are raising serious questions. Where will this substantial volume go? China is identified as the most likely destination, primarily because it doesn't recognize unilateral sanctions, already imports crude from both Russia and Iran. However, China is also cautious about excessive dependence on a single supplier, and its economy is currently not firing on all cylinders, which could limit its absorption capacity.
Chinese buyers are already being offered Russian Urals grade crude for October arrival. While Chinese refiners typically favor Eastbound variety from Russia's Far East and cut-price Iranian crude, which is better quality, they could absorb an additional 400,000 to 700,000 barrels of Urals per day, especially if prices drop further. Currently, both Eastbound and Urals trade at premiums to ICE Brent, around $2 a barrel. But Iranian crude is actually priced around $4 a barrel below ICE Brent. That's a better quality, less metal content, which Chinese independent refiners, the teapots, prefer. So what's the real story behind this global energy musical chairs? It feels like the U.S. tried to squeeze Russia, and Russia simply looks for new dance partners. How could this fundamentally reshape global oil trade routes and pricing dynamics beyond just the immediate impact on India?
You've hit on the core dynamic, and it's not just about a temporary reshuffling. The situation underscores the incredibly complex interplay of geopolitics, energy markets, national economic interests. While China certainly has the capacity and a clear motive to absorb more Russian oil, its strategic concerns about supplier diversification and its own internal economic health will temper how much it actually takes. The price differentials, quality preferences between Urals and Iranian crude also play a crucial role in Chinese refiners' decisions, demonstrating that even sanctioned oil faces stiff market competition. This ongoing shift has significant implications for global energy security, supply chain stability, as new pathways, new dependencies are being forged, potentially solidifying an east-facing energy flow for Russia, challenging traditional Western-aligned trade patterns.
Next, we turn to Section 2.2, the evolving energy mix, focusing on renewables, nuclear, and carbon markets. Let's start with how renewables are under pressure in the U.S.
This is a stark example of how immediate policy reversals can have profound, rapid market consequences for entire industries.
It really is. The Trump administration is aggressively striking against U.S. wind and solar developments. Recent actions include instituting new permitting reviews that now threaten existing and planned projects, imposing standards preventing new developments on federal land, rescinding Biden-era decisions that earmarked coastal waters for future wind turbines, and even revoking approval for a massive planned wind farm in Idaho. This broadside has already contributed to the cancellation or delay of over $22 billion worth of clean energy projects since January, and the loss of thousands of jobs, predominantly, ironically enough, in Republican states that stood to benefit from these investments.
Yeah, that is ironic.
The fascinating twist here is that it's a direct, aggressive reversal of previous climate policies, creating a highly uncertain landscape for renewable energy investors and developers. It's almost like hitting the brakes on a clean energy train that was just picking up speed, abruptly halting momentum, leaving investors in a very precarious position.
Administration officials justify these moves by stating they ensure the U.S. has an abundance of always-on power sources. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum explicitly said previous presidents gave too much preferential treatment to wind and solar, and these actions are about leveling the playing field for reliable, affordable, and built-to-last energy sources, clearly signaling a policy shift favoring traditional energy sources like fossil fuels and nuclear. This isn't just economic policy, it's a statement about energy philosophy, national security. This represents a significant political risk for the U.S. energy transition, potentially setting back climate goals, impacting the nation's competitiveness in the rapidly growing global renewable sector. While the administration frames it as ensuring reliability, grid stability, critics argue it hampers innovation, economic growth in the clean energy sector, forcing capital elsewhere. The impact is also seen beyond the U.S., as rising costs exacerbated by these policy uncertainties have already blunted political support for renewables in Europe, leading some countries to revise their ambitions. The U.K. stands out as an outlier, still pushing for offshore wind. But even they face significant cost challenges. The ripple effect of U.S. policy on global clean energy momentum is truly profound.
In stark contrast to the challenges facing renewables, we're seeing a significant nuclear power resurgence. Sure. Global electricity demand is booming, partly due to AI, electric vehicles, heat pumps, prompting a renewed interest in nuclear power. Microsoft, for instance, signed a staggering $16 billion deal to reopen the Three Mile Island nuclear plant, to power its data centers for the next 20 years.
Wow, $16 billion.
Right. However, developed countries have built only a handful of new reactors in decades. And recent projects like the Vogtle plant in the U.S., costing $37 billion, nearly triple its original cost. Or Hinkley Point C in the U.K., delayed to 2031, have faced extraordinary costs and delays. So what's the real story here? We're seeing a full circle moment, revisiting nuclear power due to surging demand. But the big question is, can we actually build these things quickly and affordably this time, avoiding the pitfalls, colossal cost overruns of past projects? The demand is certainly there, but the execution remains the formidable challenge.
Nuclear scientist Rachel Slabaugh identifies five buckets of nuclear technology that illustrate the different approaches being considered to overcome these past challenges. First, you have the old school large power plants, which countries like China continue to build at scale, often with greater efficiency. Then there are advanced reactors, potentially safer, cheaper, more fuel efficient, operating at higher temperatures for decarbonized process heat in industrial applications, facilitating fuel recycling to reduce waste radioactivity. Third, we have small modular reactors, SMRs, which are factory manufactured. This is an attempt to overcome the mega project problem by being built in controlled environments, something the West is arguably better at. Fourth, microreactors, even smaller, capable of being placed in backyards or shipping containers for hyper-localized power. However, the critical challenge for these new reactors, whether advanced or SMRs, is the 5 to 10 year timeframe for design approval and construction. This timeframe simply clashes with the immediate insatiable power demands of what she calls AI hogs, these massive data centers needing power right now. She also clarifies an important point on proliferation concerns. Nuclear reactors cannot explode like weapons. They operate on fundamentally different physics than bombs. Proliferation risks, which might arise from enrichment or recycling, are managed through rigorous international monitoring by the IAEA or by sourcing pre-enriched fuel. She emphasizes that responsible, transparent, peaceful nuclear programs are totally a thing and are managed with strict oversight. The conversation is fundamentally shifting from if we need nuclear to how we build it economically and quickly. While China clearly dominates large-scale traditional builds, the West's focus on smaller factory-built reactors is a strategic attempt to de-risk accelerate deployment, hoping to overcome past failures. The long lead times for design approval and construction, however, remain a critical hurdle for meeting immediate demand spikes from energy-intensive technologies like AI. This is truly a so-what moment for energy policy. As nations grapple with how to meet ambitious decarbonization goals while also powering a rapidly growing digital economy.
Moving to carbon markets and forest protection, we see an innovative, potentially significant approach to climate finance. Standard Chartered, or StanChart, signed a landmark $150 million carbon credits deal with Brazil's Acre State. Under this agreement, Acre could receive up to $150 million for generating approximately 5 million carbon credits. By protecting forests from threats like crop plantations, cattle ranches, these credits are expected to enter the market next year, with StanChart acting as the exclusive seller. Brazil is also actively promoting its own forest finance mechanism, a $125 billion fund called the Tropical Forest Forever Facility. Reinvigorating the voluntary carbon market, which has faced challenges due to greenwashing allegations, lack of clear standards, is a key agenda item for the upcoming UN COP the Climate Summit in Brazil. This is a truly fascinating approach to climate finance. It feels like this deal could be a blueprint for how large-scale forest protection is funded, essentially turning ecological preservation into a tangible economic asset. What makes this particular jurisdictional approach more credible than past carbon credit initiatives?
That's an excellent question. It gets to the heart of what makes this deal potentially groundbreaking. StanChart is clearly leveraging its expertise, its global network, to address the short-term economic incentive for deforestation that developing nations face. The jurisdictional approach of acres credits, meaning they span the entire state rather than just a single project, is seen as a way to significantly reduce risks of inflated environmental claims and leakage. Unlike a project-based credit, which might protect just one small forest but allow logging to simply move next door, a jurisdictional approach means the entire state commits to forest protection, offering a broader, more verifiable guarantee against harmful activities simply moving from one protected spot to an unprotected one nearby. This makes these credits more credible than traditional project-based credits, and signifies growing confidence in carbon credits as a vital financial tool for offsetting CO2 footprints, protecting natural assets. Despite the past controversies that have plagued the voluntary carbon market, it's a sign of maturing financial mechanisms in the climate space.
Finally, in this section, let's talk about infrastructure deals and how they're powering the future, particularly in emerging markets. BlackRock's Global Infrastructure Partners, GIP, is reportedly hiring aggressively for infrastructure deals in Asia. Specific focus on Southeast Asia. The International Energy Agency estimates annual investment in clean energy in Southeast Asia needs to double to $130 billion through 2030 for countries to meet their long-term climate targets. Other major lenders, including HSBC, Citigroup, Sumitomo Mitsui Banking Corp, are also targeting new blended finance deals in this market, which totaled $18 billion last year.
This indicates a significant global financial pivot towards emerging market infrastructure, particularly in clean energy, recognizing both the immense opportunity and the considerable challenge. The sheer scale of required investment highlights that traditional finance alone won't suffice. This necessitates innovative models like blended finance, which combines public and private capital, to de-risk projects and attract the massive private investment needed to achieve these ambitious climate goals. It's a recognition that simply relying on government or development bank funding won't get us there. Private capital must be mobilized on a grand scale.
We're also seeing some very dynamic shifts in battery technology and EV supply chains. U.S. battery startup Leighton has acquired what's left of Northvolt in Europe, including its flagship plant in Skellefteå, Sweden. Leighton aims to accelerate its ability to bring lithium-sulfur technology to the marketplace, plans to immediately restart operations at the Skellefteå plant, which previously employed about 3,000 people.
Meanwhile, General Motors Co. plans to purchase electric vehicle batteries from China's CATL to power its upcoming entry-level EV. This is a temporary measure until GM can procure U.S.-made LFP, lithium iron phosphate, batteries. Through its partnership with South Korea's LG Energy Solution, slated to begin output in about 2 years. This means GM will face tariffs on the Chinese imports until then, as China is the dominant source of LFP batteries globally. This looks like a dynamic battlefield out there, doesn't it? Companies racing to the next big thing in battery tech, while also navigating geopolitical tensions, the push for localized supply chains. What's the deeper implication of Leighton's acquisition? And what does GM's strategy tell us about the current state of EV supply chains?
You're right. It's a multifaceted challenge. Leighton's acquisition of Northvolt assets demonstrates the ongoing consolidation, strategic maneuvering within the battery industry, driven by the intense race for next-generation technologies like lithium sulfur. It's a smart move, acquiring existing infrastructure to accelerate development. For GM, the decision to import from China, even with the added burden of tariffs, underscores the current reliance on Chinese manufacturing capabilities for certain EV components like LFP batteries, and the long lead times required to establish robust domestic supply chains. This highlights the complex trade-offs between cost, immediate availability, and national policy objectives in the accelerating EV transition. It's a stark reminder that building out entirely new domestic supply chains takes significant time, significant investment, forcing companies to make tough, tariff-laden choices in the interim.
Let's move to Section 3, the AI revolution and its ripple effects. We'll start by examining AI hardware and development, which is truly the core of this technological race.
Yeah, this is truly the foundational layer upon which the entire AI boom is being built. And understanding the shifts here is key to understanding the broader industry.
Exactly. First, let's look at chip production and demand. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Co., TSMC, a critical player in the AI hardware ecosystem, reported a robust 26% growth spurt in July sales, totaling NT$323.2 billion, about $10.8 billion. This growth aligns perfectly with analyst expectations for a 25% increase in the company's third quarter revenue, adding to clear evidence of accelerating spending on artificial intelligence chips. TSMC, as many know, is the go-to chip maker for leading AI hardware providers like NVIDIA and AMD. So what's the fundamental takeaway from TSMC's performance? It seems to reinforce Taiwan's absolutely central role in the global AI supply chain. But what does this kind of growth truly signal about the health and growth trajectory of the entire AI industry?
Well, when TSMC sales jump like this, it's a huge, undeniable signal about the health and growth trajectory of the entire AI industry. It indicates demand for specialized AI chips isn't just strong, it's accelerating significantly. Their performance is a direct barometer of AI investment expansion worldwide, because every major AI player relies on them. This means companies aren't just talking about AI, they're putting massive capital behind it, fueling a hardware arms race that TSMC is at the very center of. What's truly fascinating, and perhaps surprising to many, is Samsung's AI chip struggles. Samsung Electronics, long renowned as the world's leading maker of DRAM chips, is now falling behind in the frenetic race for advanced AI, specifically in high bandwidth memory, HBM chips. Think of HBM chips not just as faster memory, but as the superfast express lanes AI models need to process massive data in real time. Without these specialized chips, even the most powerful AI processors hit a bottleneck, making them absolutely vital to the AI boom. SK Hynix, another South Korean company, has now surpassed Samsung as the top DRAM memory maker, commands a dominant 62% share of lucrative HBM chip shipments, with AI chip-making behemoth NVIDIA heavily reliant on its products. Samsung, by contrast, held only 17% of the global HBM business in Q2. Struggled to obtain NVIDIA's approval for its most advanced memory variety. For decades, Samsung was the undisputed leader in memory chips. Their current struggle in HBM illustrates just how quickly market leadership can shift when a new, highly specialized demand emerges, even for established giants. Given Samsung Electronics is a significant chunk of South Korea's economy, its fate in this crucial AI segment has much broader national implications. This showcases the intense, high-stakes competition at the foundational hardware layer of AI, where even a slight misstep can cost billions, redefine industry leadership.
Next, we have a big one that could reshape the automotive and AI landscape. Tesla's AI shift. Tesla Inc. is reportedly disbanding its Dojo supercomputer team, a major blow to the automaker's effort to build in-house supercomputing for driverless vehicle tech. Peter Bannon, who headed Dojo, is leaving. CEO Elon Musk has apparently ordered the effort shut down. Around 20 Dojo workers have recently moved to a new firm called Density AI. Remaining employees are being reassigned to other data center compute projects within Tesla. Now, Tesla plans to increase its reliance on external technology partners, specifically NVIDIA and AMD for compute, and Samsung Electronics for chip manufacturing, following a $16.5 billion deal with Samsung for AI semiconductors through 2033 for an upcoming plant in Texas. Musk even hinted at this strategic pivot in a recent earnings call, suggesting future in-house tech might converge with partners. This is a big one. For years, Dojo was seen as absolutely central to Tesla's multi-billion-dollar AI ambitions, a cornerstone of their vertical integration strategies. Its disbandment signals a major strategic pivot, and it raises an important question. Why this sudden change of course for such a high-profile, internally developed project? It seems like they're opting for partnership over pure vertical integration, which could have huge implications for the entire AI and automotive sectors.
You've highlighted the core dilemma perfectly. This shift could be primarily driven by the immense costs, the highly specialized expertise required for top-tier AI supercomputing. Rather than continuing to compete directly with chip giants like NVIDIA and AMD, Tesla appears to be leveraging established leaders. Recognizing the efficiency, the speed that external partnerships can offer, this pragmatic approach might actually accelerate their driverless tech development by tapping into proven capabilities, which is critical in a fast-moving field. However, it also means relying on external supply chains, which would carry their own risks given the explosive demand for AI chips. It's a classic build-or-buy dilemma playing out at the cutting edge of technology, with Tesla seemingly choosing to buy rather than build some of its most critical components, potentially setting a precedent for other companies in this space who might find it more efficient to outsource certain AI infrastructure.
Now, let's look at OpenAI's GPT-5 and the intensifying AI competition. OpenAI is rolling out its more powerful, long-awaited new AI model, GPT-5. Unveiled during a live-streamed event, GPT-5 is designed for enhanced capabilities in coding, creative writing, reasoning through complex queries. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman called it a major upgrade, stating that for the first time, it really feels like talking to an expert in any topic. Early adopters, like Lovable co-founder Anton Osika, noted GPT-5's superior ability to quickly build complicated applications, fix software bugs by producing easier-to-maintain computer code. So what does this all mean? GPT-5 sounds like a leap forward, making AI even more practical and accessible. But the competition in this space is heating up faster than ever.
Oh, absolutely. The rapid innovation cycles, the fierce competition in the AI model space are truly remarkable. GPT-5's enhanced capabilities promise to transform how software is developed, how we interact with AI, pushing the boundaries. However, OpenAI, while a frontrunner, faces renewed competition from former employees, powerful rivals, Alphabet's Google, Anthropic, Elon Musk's xAI. They've all released their own reasoning models and agent products. Chinese firms like DeepSeek are gaining ground. Meta Platforms is spending heavily to hire top talent from a new AI lab, poaching over a dozen employees from OpenAI. This intense rivalry is also clearly reflected in the venture capital market. A German AI startup, NAN, expected to raise funding at a valuation of $2.3 billion, an astounding jump from $350 million just 4 months prior, demonstrating strong demand for AI investments, particularly in Europe. This environment fuels incredible advancements, but also raises important questions about market concentration, the eventual accessibility of these powerful tools. The intense pace means companies need to pivot from developing in secret to deploying rapidly. Mm-hmm. For investors, this means looking beyond the headline names to companies providing the infrastructure for these AI models, as they're the ones guaranteed to benefit regardless of who wins the model race. ensuring they're insulated from the who has the best GPT volatility.
Let's shift gears to section 3.2, AI's impact on labor and surveillance. First up, AI in a labor market. The July jobs report, with its signs of labor market softness, raises a critical question. Is artificial intelligence impacting knowledge workers? Data suggests a significant shift. The share of entry-level hires among the biggest tech companies, Meta, Alphabet, and Microsoft, has slumped by 50% since 2019. Meanwhile, overall employee headcount growth for these same companies has slowed dramatically to just 3% over the past 3 years, compared to a massive 64% from 2019 to 2022. Consultancy firm McKinsey is reportedly assembling smaller but more experienced teams as it integrates AI, and CEOs are increasingly talking about AI eventually leading to significant layoffs. These tech giants collectively plan over $250 billion in capital expenditures on AI infrastructure in the next 12 months. Okay, let's unpack this. It seems like AI is not just changing what we do, but who gets to do it. Are we seeing the beginning of a truly fundamental reshaping of the workforce, particularly for entry-level roles in those traditional career paths?
That's precisely the concern. The data strongly suggests a trade-off between investing heavily in AI and hiring human workers. While specialized expertise clearly becomes more valuable in the short term as companies hire smaller, more experienced teams, the long-term implications of AI on job creation, particularly for new entrants to the workforce, are a critical concern. This isn't just about efficiency gains or augmenting human capabilities. It's about a potential structural shift where significant capital investment in AI may directly substitute for labor. This raises important questions about future employment strategies, the skills required for the workforce of tomorrow, and ultimately, economic inclusivity. How do we ensure broad opportunity in an increasingly AI-driven economy?
Now, let's look at AI in surveillance. Flock Safety, a controversial surveillance startup, recently announced it will add artificial intelligence to its products used by U.S. police departments, stating it will help make society safer. However, privacy advocates are calling this move abominable, arguing these products provide customers with vast surveillance capabilities with little accountability. Critics like Dave Maz from the Electronic Frontier Foundation assert Flock's primary goal is to make money, not necessarily enhance safety, and that their role in governing the use of their technology is minimal at best. Okay. So what does this all mean? It's a classic tech dilemma, innovation for safety versus privacy concerns. This raises an important question. Who watches the watchers, especially when AI is involved?
This is a critical discussion. And the integration of AI into surveillance tech certainly amplifies the existing ethical tensions between public safety, individual privacy. While proponents argue for increased efficiency in law enforcement, critics highlight the substantial potential for widespread monitoring, bias in algorithms, lack of transparency. The debate over who controls these powerful AI tools, what mechanisms are in place for oversight, accountability, will become increasingly central as such technologies become more prevalent. It really forces society to confront the trade-offs between perceived safety and fundamental civil liberties.
Transitioning to Section 3.3, let's explore digital transformation and urban changes. We'll begin with a fascinating phenomenon of digital nomads and their surprising impact on urban housing.
Yeah, this is a compelling story of urban reinvention meeting global work trends with tangible effects on local communities.
Indeed. Digital nomads are truly transforming the Dellens housing market. The city is seeing a boom in viviendas turísticas, or tourist homes, purpose-built short-term rental properties, combining elements of boutique hotels, co-living spaces, studio apartments. These are specifically targeted at the growing number of digital nomads, mostly under 45. From Latin America, Europe, the U.S., staying for varied durations, an estimated 90 such properties, ranging from small to large-scale towers, are either under construction or recently completed. Medellin, once infamous for cartel violence, has been actively rebranding since the early 2000s through ambitious urban design projects, aiming to shed its past image. Here's where it gets really interesting. Medellin's transformation is a testament to urban resilience, but the rise of viviendas turísticas also poses a fascinating challenge. Who knew the remote work trend would so profoundly reshape urban real estate in places like this?
Well, while developers aim for conscious tourism and urban planners hope these properties will reduce pressure on residential buildings, there are significant concerns about gentrification, displacement of local residents, mirroring issues seen in cities like Mexico City. This phenomenon highlights how global work trends are directly impacting local housing markets, demanding continuous adaptation from city officials to manage the influx, ensure equitable urban development.
Now for an unexpected turn. Let's talk about Starlink's challenges in Kenya. Elon Musk's Starlink satellite comm service launched in Kenya in 2023, aiming to revolutionize the internet market is now losing subscribers in one thriving urban areas. Starlink lost over 10% of its Kenyan subscribers in Q1 2025. In contrast, the overall market for fixed internet subscriptions in Kenya grew by 8%.
Interesting contrast.
Consumers are reportedly unplugging their Starlink dishes, switching back to faster local providers. Experts believe it's too late for Starlink to make a comeback in the region's urban markets, suggest it should focus on rural customers. This is a surprising fact. You'd think high-speed satellite internet would be a slam dunk. But it turns out market dynamics are more complex than just raw speed. It goes to show that even disruptive technologies face stiff competition from established local players.
It's a crucial lesson in market entry and adaptation. Starlink's struggles in Kenyan urban markets underscore that technological superiority alone doesn't guarantee success. Factors like competitive local pricing, reliability, customer service, and the specific needs of urban versus rural populations can heavily influence adoption. This case study offers a valuable lesson on the nuances of market entry and adaptation in diverse global contexts, particularly in emerging economies where local solutions often prove more resilient than initially perceived.
And finally in this section, let's examine London's luxury hotel market. London's luxury hotel market has finally hit its price ceiling. Data from Four Travel shows average nightly rates at five-star properties are anywhere from 20% to 50% lower than the same period in 2024. This drop is largely driven by heightened competition from a continuous parade of ultra-luxury openings. While new properties like the Chancery Rosewood aim for £1,280 a night, others like Six Senses will likely price around £700. In contrast, seasonal destinations like the Amalfi Coast or the south of France can maintain sky-high rates due to limited availability. London's a year-round destination.
Right. This indicates a potential oversupply in London's high-end hospitality sector, leading to price corrections despite continued investment in new luxury properties. It highlights the fundamental difference in market dynamics between seasonal and year-round destinations. Scarcity drives prices in the former, sustained competition impacts the latter. It's a clear signal, and even the most exclusive markets are subject to supply and demand forces. Saturation can lead to significant price adjustments.
We move now to Section 4, Geopolitical Tensions and Social Trends. We'll start with international relations and regional conflicts.
Yeah, this section reveals how global flashpoints continue to shape our world, alongside shifting domestic landscapes, often with very immediate human impacts.
Let's begin with the ongoing Israel-Gaza conflict. Israeli PM Benjamin Netanyahu recently stated in an interview that the country's military plans to take full control of Gaza in a final push to topple Hamas, but stressed Israel does not intend to govern the Palestinian territory long term. He expressed a desire to liberate ourselves and the people of Gaza from Hamas's leadership, aiming to hand it over to Arab forces who will govern it properly without threatening us, end quote. This potential escalation comes after 22 months of fighting that has devastated Gaza. The UN World Food Program reports 500,000 people are starving. Despite calls for a ceasefire from many Western governments, polls suggest the majority of Israelis would prefer the war to continue if that's the cost of recovering hostages.
This signifies a critical juncture in the conflict, indicating a potential final military push with immense humanitarian implications. Netanyahu's vision for post-Hamas Gaza is profoundly complex, involving the highly sensitive idea of external Arab forces governing the territory, maintaining a security perimeter, rather than direct Israeli governance. This raises fundamental questions about the future stability and administration of the territory, and how such plans reconcile with international calls for humanitarian relief, a lasting peace. The path forward remains incredibly uncertain, fraught with immense challenges.
Shifting to another region, we see Turkey's media crackdown. A Turkish court has ruled to block the popular YouTube channel of Fatih Altaylı, an independent journalist with over 1.6 million subscribers, following his arrest on charges of threatening President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. In a striking display of solidarity, a broadcast of Altaylı's empty seat actually attracted views exceeding his subscriber count. Various figures from politics, media, the arts have since broadcast from his seat, making a symbolic statement. So what does this all mean? This is a stark reminder about the delicate balance of press freedom in various parts of the world. It's a surprising fact that despite the crackdown, there's this visible public outpouring of support for independent journalism.
This action raises serious concerns about media freedom, suppression of dissent in Turkey. The public and political response, particularly those symbolic acts of solidarity, highlights the importance of independent media, the persistent struggle for free expression, even in the face of state pressure.
Let's also look at the UK's international engagement, showing some interesting shifts. First, Zimbabwe ties. The UK and Zimbabwe are rekindling diplomatic ties after almost three decades of tension, driven by a global surge in demand for critical minerals. The UK is pursuing $1 billion in deals reflecting its strategic interest. Zimbabwe, in turn, has adopted an economic diplomacy strategy to leverage its resources.
This re-engagement highlights how geopolitical priorities are shifting due to resource scarcity and demand. Demonstrates a pragmatic approach to diplomacy, where historical tensions can be set aside in favor of economic and strategic imperatives driven by the global energy transition.
And on a more domestic front, the UK has a new migrant returns treaty with France. The UK has detained the first small boat migrants under this new one-in, one-out returns treaty, a pilot program aiming to stem illegal crossings across the English Channel, which hit a record high in the first 6 months of this year. UK plans to make referrals to France within 3 days. France has 14 days to respond. This is an important question. How effective can a one-in, one-out system truly be in addressing a complex migration challenge that's already reached record levels? It really puts pressure on the Prime Minister's promise to tackle this issue.
This move signals the UK government's intensified efforts to address migration, driven by domestic political pressure, concerns about public services. However, such treaties often face significant legal, logistical, humanitarian challenges. The tension between security and human rights remains a central debate, with figures like Rees-Mogg criticizing it as potentially ineffective against human rights claims.
And in a fascinating diplomatic development, Trump's Nobel Peace Prize nominations. Cambodia formally nominated President Donald Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize stems from Trump's intervention in recent armed conflict between Cambodia and Thailand, where he threatened to halt trade deals unless a ceasefire was agreed, credited with averting conflict. Pakistan also nominated Trump for mediating its conflict with India, although India has consistently denied his role. So what does this all mean? It's a fascinating look at the intersection of diplomacy, economic leverage, public relations on the world stage, highlights the strategic use of tariffs, not just as economic tools, but as powerful bargaining chips in geopolitical disputes.
These nominations reflect how certain nations perceive and respond to Trump's visionary and innovative diplomacy, which often relies on economic coercion. Also underscores the unusual nature of a major world leader being nominated based on actions that challenge established norms of international relations, particularly with allies, raises questions about the definition of peace brokering in the modern era.
Now let's pivot to section 4.2, domestic political dynamics. We'll start by looking at Japan's political heat.
Yeah, this is a classic case of internal party strife potentially leading to significant national leadership changes, affecting policy, international standing.
Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba is facing intensified criticism from his own party, following a dismal result in a recent upper house election, significantly weakened his mandate, triggered internal momentum to replace him. Despite calls for resignation, Ishiba has held firm, repeatedly expressing intent to remain in power, seeking opinions on agricultural disaster prevention policies. A critical point will likely be late August when an LDP committee finalizes findings on election results, potentially leading to LDP Secretary General Hiroshi Moriyama stepping down, which could further weaken Ishiba's position.
This situation points to considerable political instability within Japan's ruling party. Internal challenges to Ishiba's leadership, especially after a significant electoral setback, could lead to a change in prime minister. Such political shifts can have widespread implications for domestic policy, economic stability, Japan's international role, especially given recent geopolitical tensions.
Next, the contentious U.S. gerrymandering debate. Florida Republicans considering redrawing the state's congressional map, aiming to add more GOP seats for 2026 midterms, part of a national push. In response, Texas Democratic legislators fled the state to prevent a quorum, blocked the proposal. California Democrats promised to fight fire with fire. New York Governor Kathy Hochul proposed disbanding her state's bipartisan redistricting committee, stating, "Politics is a political process."
Okay.
President Trump also pressuring Republican-led states like Ohio, Missouri, Indiana to begin mid-decade redistricting. Okay, let's unpack this. It's a full-blown national battle over who draws the lines, getting incredibly aggressive. The idea of politicians choosing their voters rather than the other way around is a core threat to Democratic principles.
This race to the bottom in gerrymandering is highly corrosive to democracy. While Democrats argue they must respond to Republican efforts, many good government advocates warn legitimizing such tactics could undermine democracy itself, potentially not even secure a long-term advantage. This legal and political struggle will have profound consequences for future election outcomes, balance of power in Congress.
And a quick look at Haiti's instability. Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, one of Haiti's most powerful gang leaders, head of the Vivants and Gang Coalition, is threatening to attack the prime minister's office, other government branches. Comes as the troubled nation prepares for a leadership transition.
This highlights the severe, ongoing political and security crisis in Haiti. The direct threat to government institutions from organized gang violence underscores the profound challenges to governance stability, making any leadership transition incredibly precarious, signaling a deepening humanitarian crisis.
And in Mexico, the ruling party is under scrutiny. Mexico's ruling leftist Morena Party, led by President Claudia Sheinbaum, known for its frugality brand. Facing criticism after senior leaders seen on expensive foreign vacations, Andres Lopez Beltran, party's number three official, son of the founder, reportedly vacationing at a luxury Tokyo hotel, photos published, skipped a party gathering. Another Morena leader, Ricardo Monreal, faced scrutiny for a vacation in Spain. It's a bit of personality, but it points to a surprising fact about how optics, perceived hypocrisy, can truly undermine a party's core identity, especially one built on austerity. Raises an important question. How much can a political brand be stretched before it breaks?
These incidents threaten to anger the millions of mostly poor Mexicans who form the party's base, whose support is built on that image of austerity. If the scandal deepens, it could erode public trust in Morena Sheinbaum's government, illustrating how personal actions of leaders can contradict political messaging, have significant repercussions for public perception, political stability.
Let's wrap up our deep dive with section 4.3, social phenomena. We'll start with doodles and the pet industry.
This is a fascinating look at how consumer trends can rapidly transform a niche interest into a massive economic force, complete with market dynamics.
It's certainly not what you'd expect. Doodles, like golden doodles, have become a cutthroat billion-dollar dog industry. Popularity is immense. Insurance policies on doodles increased over 160% from 2013 through 2021. Judy Hahn, Amy Lane, were among first U.S. breeders of labradoodles, describing how demand caught on like wildfire. However, market has seen shifts. Post-COVID, demand slowed, forcing even reputable breeders like Hahn to spend $5,000 a month on SEO advertising to sell dogs that used to sell themselves, indicating peak doodles. I agree. The AKC acceptance process, seen with the Bure Terrier, accepted 2021 after 40 years, is crucial for a breed to become popular, increase value. I never thought about dog breeds as an industry, but here's where it gets really interesting. It's a perfect example of a niche becoming a massive market, complete with its own bubbles, market corrections. It's a surprising fact that even a reputable breeder needs to spend so much on advertising now.
This phenomenon highlights the commodification of pets, where consumer demand for specific traits drives a specialized breeding market. The shift post-COVID from effortless sales to heavy marketing mirrors trends in other consumer markets, underscores how rapidly demand can fluctuate, also brings into focus challenges of ethical breeding, the long process of breed recognition in a market driven by consumer trends.
Now for a more serious social issue, WNBA sex toy incidents. The WNBA grappling with a string of sex toy disturbances in late July, early August. Incidents reported in Atlanta, Chicago, LA, New York, Phoenix. Objects landed on court. One nearly hitting Fever guard Sophie Cunningham. Perpetrators arrested on charges like assault, disorderly conduct. Arena security faces significant challenges because the sex toys generally lack metal components. Undetectable by metal detectors. Difficult to detect when carried on a spectator's body. So what does this all mean? This isn't just a quirky news item. It's a serious issue impacting player safety, integrity of the game. Raises an important question. How can arenas adapt security protocols without creating massive bottlenecks for fans?
This issue extends beyond security. It's a significant social problem. WNBA players, coaches like Minnesota Lynx coach Cheryl Reeve, view these incidents as the sexualization of women used to hold women down rather than a joke, highlights deeply problematic behavior disproportionately targeting a women's league with a high profile of lesbian queer players. Fact that crypto-based prediction markets are even offering wagers on future incidents underscores a disturbing normalization, demands a more robust response from league law enforcement.
Shifting to Europe, France's Nicolas and white-collar populism. The Nicolas meme emerged in France. Represents a 40-something white-collar professional who feels utterly screwed. This high earner, not rich yet, Henry, archetype, believes almost half his wage goes to a state whose handouts he doesn't receive. While boomers enjoy pensions he fears he'll never have, real wage gains in France slowed. Longer life expectancy puts more pressure on public finances, social outlays, pensions-consuming spending. While France has lower income inequality than US or UK, there's rising tax pressure among net contributors. It's a bit of personality, but it points to a surprising fact about social sentiment. This isn't just wealth inequality. It's perceived fairness, the social contract. It's fascinating how these feelings are being articulated, amplified through a meme.
The Nicolas meme reflects a brewing discontent among a significant segment of the French working population, tapping into white-collar populism. This resentment is being actively taken up by Marine Le Pen and her entourage. Centrist contender Edouard Philippe also promising to address these workers' concerns ahead of the 2027 presidential election, highlights a growing societal friction over distribution of resources, benefits, potential to reshape the political landscape.
Finally, teaching kids poker. A unique approach starts with one-card poker. Each player gets one face-down card, bets. Simplifies game, focusing on concepts like valuing one's hand, inducing others to bet, bluffing, understanding position. Goal, not complex hand rankings, but maximizing value, understanding probabilities. Playing for chips means kids motivated by thrill of the game, satisfaction of taking chips, not financial stakes. This is a truly inventive way to teach strategic thinking, even basics of market behavior to kids. Surprising fact, you can distill such a complex game down to these core engaging elements.
Offers a fascinating insight into foundational principles of game theory, behavioral economics. By stripping away complex rules, highlights how quickly even young minds grasp concepts like risk assessment, reading opponents, strategic decision making. Emphasis on intrinsic motivation rather than monetary reward provides a fresh perspective on learning competition.
We move now to section 5, financial sector and capital markets. We'll start with public market activity, IPOs, and listings.
Right. This section reveals where capital is flowing and where investors are finding or losing confidence in various sectors.
Let's kick off with medical tech IPOs. HeartFlu Inc., an AI software platform for heart disease, successfully priced this IPO at $19 a share. Above marketed range, raising $317 million. Values company at $1.54 billion. However, follows a rough investor reception for other recent medical tech listings. Shoulder Innovations Inc. raised $75 million. Carlsmed Inc. raised $100.5 million last month, but shares of both currently trading below offering prices.
While HeartFlu's successful pricing indicates some appetite for AI-driven medical tech, the underperformance of others suggests a discerning market. Highlights AI alone isn't a guarantee of post-IPO success. Investors scrutinizing fundamentals, competitive landscapes closely.
Next, Firefly Aerospace IPO. Firefly Aerospace planning a public offering. Comes after a consequential year. Successful moon landing of its robotic spacecraft, Blue Ghost, in March. Partnership with NASA. Only privately developed spacecraft to land upright, intact on lunar surface. Firefly holds multiple NASA contracts, developing larger rocket, Eclipse with Northrop Grumman, satellite line, Elytra. Funds raised will ramp up Alpha rocket cadence, fast-track other product lines, addressing more demand than supply. Path to public offering described as more traditional compared to SPAC frenzy, which saw many space players struggle. This is a great story. Perseverance, innovation in space. Surprising fact, a company with a rocky past, mixed launch record, is poised to go public after such a historic moon landing. Shows renewed investor confidence.
Firefly's IPO represents a critical test for sustainability of private space ventures beyond the SPAC boom. Diversification into satellite manufacturing, larger rockets, suggests a more robust business model. Similar to Rocket Lab, successful moon landing, significant technical achievement, clearly provides narrative momentum needed to attract investors in a market now more selective.
Also, Torrent Gas IPO in India. Torrent Gas LTD, City Gas Distribution Unit of Torrent Group, considering IPO in Mumbai, could raise about $450 million. Could value company around $3 billion. Proceeds likely for CapEx, debt reduction.
This potential IPO signals robust growth opportunities in India's energy infrastructure sectors, particularly urban gas distribution, underscores India's active capital markets, investor confidence in domestic growth stories, even amidst global trade tensions.
Looking to Southeast Asia, Singapore Exchange, SGX IPO revival, SGX gearing up for IPO revival. Approximately 30 companies in pipeline looking to go public. Includes interest from firms like LinkReit, Praemia Rhyme, REIT's a strong suit for SGX. Others like UltraGreen.ai, Neon. SGX shares already risen over 60% in past year, outpacing Singapore's Straits Times Index, positioned Singapore for rebound in new equity listings, after largely watching while Hong Kong, India boomed, raising $39 billion this year. So what does this all mean? Seems Singapore stepping back into spotlight as listing destination. Fact Exchange's own shares soaring suggests confidence in this upcoming IPO wave. Could make it major player again.
Indicates strategic effort by SGX to attract new listings, compete more effectively. Diverse pipeline suggests broad-based revival. Given previous quiet period, this shift could enhance Singapore's role as financial hub, provide new investment opportunities, but faces ongoing competition from robust markets in Hong Kong, India.
And Thai Airways shares soar. Thai Airways International PCL shares climbed to highest level in almost 8 years. After state-controlled airline reported Q2 net income soared by nearly 39-fold from year earlier.
Remarkable earnings jump suggests very strong recovery in global aviation tourism, particularly benefiting airlines in regions with increased travel demand. Could indicate successful restructuring or significant increase in passenger volumes, yields, pointing to broader industry rebound.
Moving to Section 5.2, investment trends and strategies. Starting with Europe's defense credit boom.
Yeah, this is a profound shift, driven by geopolitical realities, significant implications for how capital is allocated across Europe.
The buzz is, the hottest new credit deals in Europe are anything to do with defense. Significant rush to tap into Europe's military buildup. Credit markets providing bulk of cash for manufacturers to ramp up production, fulfill trillions of euros worth of orders from governments. Even struggling companies, or those tangentially linked, attracting credit investors. E.g., Maxim Prill, Utilsat Communications SA, blue chip funds like Carlyle, Ares, boutique shops like Pemberton Asset Management actively seeking to lend more. Trend viewed as irreversible, multi-year shift, driven by European leaders' determination to reduce reliance on U.S. military might, spurred partly by President Trump. While ESG restrictions previously complicated investments, attitudes, rules changing. Here's where it gets really interesting. Defense sector, traditionally niche, now hotbed of activity. Driven by geopolitical imperative. Surprising fact, even companies tangentially linked benefiting. Huge long-term shift for European finance.
Represents fundamental reevaluation of defense sector in European financial markets. Shift in ESG considerations reflects broader societal political acceptance of military buildup given current geopolitical realities. Challenges remain in vetting obscure companies, deploying capital effectively. But strong demand, long-term government commitments signal sustained growth. Creating significant opportunities for private credit firms. Tangible financial manifestation of Europe's rearmament drive.
Also, Indonesia's benchmark yield falls. Indonesia's 10-year bond yield fallen to lowest level in almost 2 years, 6.42%, attributed to rising interest rate cut expectations, strong overseas inflows, weakening U.S. dollar. Emerging Asian sovereign bonds, including Indonesia's, rallied this year as global funds diversify away from dollar assets, especially after weaker U.S. payroll data boosted bets on Fed rate cut in September.
Reflects broader global investment trend. As U.S. dollar weakens, Fed signals potential rate cuts. Emerging market assets, particularly high-yielding bonds, become more attractive, suggests confidence in Indonesia's economic stability, allows for more domestically supportive policy stance via rate cuts, should further drive down yields, attract more foreign capital.
Let's turn to India's pension fund shift to equities. India's major state-owned pension funds pivoting away from sovereign bonds, increasing equity holdings. Follows regulatory change in March, raising allowed equity proportion to 25% from 15%. First 3 months of fiscal year, three largest funds bought 289 billion rupees, $3.3 billion, more equities than bonds. Stark contrast to previous 3 months. Move aims to boost diversification, provide better retirement savings. India equities, Nifty 50, have returned over 130% in the past 5 years versus 15% for sovereign bonds. So what does this all mean? Massive reallocation of capital within India, driven by policy change, pursuit of higher returns, significant implications for stock, bond markets there.
Represents significant challenge for India's sovereign debt market. Reduces major source of demand. Highlights growing sophistication of Indian pension funds. Focus on maximizing returns. Puts greater pressure on federal government to manage finances prudently. Especially as economy faces threats from U.S. tariffs, geopolitical instability. Transition to new 25% cap expected to take about a year.
And the Australian pension tax fallout. New Australian pension tax, set to be legislated soon, imposes additional 15% tax on pension balances of $83 million, $2 million and above, on top of existing 15% rate, affects 80,000 people. Spurred behind-the-scenes planning by wealth managers, clients to explore strategies like trusts, insurance bonds to shield balances, major concern. $83 million threshold, not index. Real value arose with inflation, eventually catching more individuals. Taxing unrealized capital gains could force asset sales.
Policy highlights ongoing debate about wealth redistribution, tax fairness. While aimed at high earners, lack of indexation means it broadens reach over time, potentially impacting a larger segment. Strategies explored by wealth managers demonstrate proactive measures by affluent savers to mitigate tax impacts, underscoring complexities of tax policy, its influence on investment behavior.
Also, gold's weekly gain. Gold on track for biggest weekly climb in a month. Surge attributed to two main factors. Recent implementation of U.S. tariffs, President Trump's naming of temporary Fed governor, expected to echo calls for lower interest rates.
Gold's performance here, classic example of safe haven role. Times of increased geopolitical uncertainty, trade wars, expectations of dovish monetary policy, lower rates make non-yielding gold attractive. Demand typically rises. Reflects investor sentiment seeking stability amidst volatility.
Finally, crypto market unease and Trump ties. Crypto's $25 billion spree sparks unease even among insiders. So-called digital asset treasury firms, DATs, announced plans to raise combined $79 billion in 2025 for Bitcoin purchases. Trend of expanding into smaller tokens, altcoins, estimated $25 billion planned funding, sheer number of efforts causing unease. Several large DATs like Metaplanet, Upexi, seen stock prices swoon despite accumulating significant crypto holdings. Here's where it gets really interesting. Two sides of crypto coin. Massive institutional political interest, even from Trump family. Winklevoss Twins reported invested in new crypto mining venture tied to Eric Trump. Donald Trump Jr., Evgeny Gokberg's Re7 Capital, has partnership with Trump family-affiliated World Liberty Financial. President Trump signed executive order easing access to crypto and 401ks. Order also directs regulators to remove reputational risk standards, identify unlawful debanking. On the other hand, signs of speculative overheating, unease among insiders. Is this mainstream adoption or bubble waiting to burst, especially when politics gets involved?
Rapid capital flow into DATs, particularly altcoins, signals significant market exuberance, potentially speculative behavior. Disconnect between asset value, stock price apparent. Growing ties between political figures, crypto industry, exemplified by Trump family ventures, executive order, suggests significant push for favorable policy changes. Introduces political risk, questions about regulatory oversight, especially debanking could reshape relationship between financial institutions, clients based on ideology, volatile mix of finance, tech, politics, mainstream adoption, battling speculative excesses, unpredictable government intervention.
Finally, Section 5.3, Corporate Governance and Finance, starting with Blackstone Bright leadership change.
Yeah, a challenging moment for a major financial institution grappling with unexpected profound loss.
Blackstone Inc.'s Real Estate Income Trust, Bright, $53 billion trust, major profit engine, named Rob Harper, co-president, as interim CEO. Follows tragic death of top official Wes LePatner. Among four killed in NYC office tower shooting last week, LePatner recently became Bright CEO, also in charge of Blackstone's Core Plus real estate business. Harper, with Blackstone since 2002, retains existing roles while board searches for permanent head.
Profound, somber development. Highlights human impact of unexpected tragedies on major financial institutions. Underscores challenges of leadership transition, especially in large organizations like Bright. Tasked with delivering steady returns during elevated interest rates. Focus now on how quickly, effectively, interim leadership maintains stability, guides trust forward.
Next, PetroDiamonds refinancing. PetroDiamonds announced comprehensive refinancing plan. Includes increase in margin, updated covenant package for bank debt, principal amount of bonds amended to 96% of outstanding value, interest payable in cash or shares. Company also pursued $25 million rights issue, underwritten by some shareholders. Stock reacted positively, jumping 49% Friday after announcement, strong Q4 operating update, refinancing expected Q4 pending shareholder lender consent.
Plan represents critical step for PetroDiamonds to stabilize financial position, manage debt. Market strong positive reaction suggests investors view terms favorably. Believe it will significantly de-risk company, allowing focus on operations. Combination of debt restructuring, rights issue common strategy for companies seeking to deleverage, gain financial flexibility.
Lastly, Turkish Airlines acquisition interest. Turkish Airlines considering strategic move to acquire Air Europa, marks significant growth plan. Previously, British Airways owner IAGSA attempted to buy Air Europa twice, both attempts nixed by competition regulators. Other Middle Eastern airlines expanded through minority stakes in regional rivals. Though Etihad's past investments largely failed due to lack of full control to orchestrate turnarounds.
Highlights consolidation trend in airline industry. Driven by desire for strategic growth, expanded international reach. History of IAG's blocked attempts underscores stringent regulatory scrutiny over airline mergers. Etihad's past failures offer cautionary tale about importance of securing sufficient control in acquisitions, suggests Turkish Airlines will be wary of similar pitfalls. Acquisition could significantly reshape air travel routes if successful, creating stronger competitor.
What a whirlwind of information we've unpacked today. From the fluctuating tides of the global economy where trade wars, central bank decisions are reshaping markets, challenging long-held assumptions, to the cutting edge of AI, the surprising shifts it's bringing to industries, labor markets, even urban living. We've seen how deeply interconnected our world truly is, how a tariff in one corner can affect a company's profits halfway across the globe, or how AI demand can revive interest in nuclear power.
Indeed. We've delved into the complex interplay of geopolitics, technology, social trends, simultaneously shaping our lives. Whether it's the financial maneuvering in Europe's burgeoning defense sector, the surprising struggles, successes in battery space industries, or the fascinating, sometimes challenging, social shifts like digital nomads transforming cities, unexpected issues faced by WNBA. The profound implication here is the constant state of flux, the often unpredictable impacts these changes have on our daily lives, and for your ability to be truly well-informed in a world of information overload.
As we've explored today, the flow of information, goods, even people, is being reshaped by powerful forces we're still trying to fully grasp. From the nuances of global trade, future of energy, to the very fabric of our cities, our social interactions, this raises an important question. As the world becomes increasingly interconnected yet simultaneously fragmented by new policies, technologies, how do you adapt your own strategies for staying informed, making sense of it all? Especially when the lines between verifiable facts, compelling narratives become increasingly blurred. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this exploration has given you new insights, perhaps sparked new questions. Keep digging, keep connecting the dots, and keep seeking those aha moments.
Until next time. Continue to question assumptions, consider different viewpoints, and always be open to learning more. Remember, knowledge is most valuable when understood and applied.